This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians from the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7am to late 30am.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. I'm in the studio with Inez and this is Priya. Good morning, Inez.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
I'm very cold. I didn't expect this sudden change. I was like, now I'm coming into radio and the sun is up. That was a strange surprise.
Yes, the sun's up. It's cold. And the other day I was feeling, you know, it feels like it wasn't even that long ago that I was so optimistic. I was like, oh, can I wear shorts? No, not now. No, we're not ready for shorts. It's too cold.
It's not right. Everybody has the right to shorts.
Everybody has the right to shorts. But also, you know, as various people have been noting, there are some seasonal changes we're seeing that are coming earlier than usual. We're heading into a extremely hot summer period. And I think, yeah, being attentive to the wildlife around you with H5N1 bird flu spreading and to how seasons are changing a little bit differently is important and something that I've certainly been doing, especially paying attention to local bird life. It's been a very sobering time, I think, but I guess all we can do is lean into mitigation strategies as best as possible.
Lean on me when you're not strong. Learn about the weather and the changes.
And if you do see any sick or injured birds, especially with the H5N1 flu spreading around and cases being detected in government areas, including Marybeck, make sure that you head to BirdLife Australia or to the Australian government's websites where you can find information about what to do. Don't approach or touch any sick bird life that you find, but make sure that you head to those websites. Now, what have we got on for today?
First up, we have long-time listener, long-time caller, Scott Drummond, Head of Policy and Practice at VADA, the peak body for Victorian Alcohol and Other Drug Agencies, to talk about International Overdose Awareness Day. That was on Monday, the 31st of August. And the theme was 21 years on, still needed. And we talk about the record numbers of heroin-related overdoses in Victoria, which are increasing, but sadly for the first time, we have Geelong, Greater Geelong, taking the leading record. So we discuss the urgent call from Geelong to address their overdose crisis, as well as VADA's key statewide election asks.
And then after that, we'll be joined by Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, to talk about Rahu's recent successes with collective tenant bargaining and the implications for future tenant organising in Victoria. And we will also be talking a little bit about some upcoming rental reforms that come into effect from mid-October and a bit about the state elections as well. And then after that, we'll be joined by Bibi Oliver, who's a Bardi Jawi poet, author, illustrator, and artistic director and CEO of Black and Bright, to talk about the opening of the 2026 Black and Bright Literary Festival, the theme of which is Every When, and it centers First Nations understandings of time as continuous and relational. And the festival will be running from today, Thursday, the 3rd of September, until this Sunday, the 6th. And after that, we will hopefully be joined by some of the AI Safety Symposium's crew to have a bit more of a conversation about the importance of developing critical literacy en masse about artificial intelligence in an era of toxic tech industry boosterism and regulatory ambivalence. And finally, we will be joined by Dr. Ruchira Talukdar, who is the co-founder and coordinator of SUPNA South Asian Climate Solidarity, who will be speaking with us about the importance of situating the recent catastrophic flooding in Nepal and Tibet in the broader context of climate change effects in the Himalayas. And we'll also be talking about the importance of holding high-emitting wealthy countries such as Australia to account to provide climate finance to regions bearing the brunt of climate disaster.
Huge show, so we'll be right back with our headlines.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now, the Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 3rd of September. 1 week after a glacier collapse that triggered devastating flash floods across the Nepal-Tibet border, more than 1,100 deaths are confirmed and more than 4,500 people remain missing. Rescue teams are continuing searches, but authorities and responders are also shifting towards relief and rehabilitation efforts amid widespread destruction of community infrastructure and serious public health risks.
Also in news this week, new First Nations and disability-led research has found that many First Nations people with disabilities in custody are spending long periods on remand, often without being convicted, and fail to receive the adequate care they require. The Barriers Within Bars report from Blackability reviewed 177 studies and interviews with people with lived experience and justice professionals. And just 18 of those studies examined the intersections of First Nations identity, disability and incarceration. The report found that disability is often unrecognised or misunderstood, and that bail and remand practices frequently fail to account for cultural obligations and disability needs. The research also found that incarceration can disrupt family connections and access to disability services, including the National Disability Insurance Scheme supports.
In related news, FlatOut and the Human Rights Law Centre are calling on the Victorian government to establish a dedicated legal service for women, trans and gender diverse people who are incarcerated. The Dignity Behind Bars report found significant gaps in access to justice and widespread human rights concerns, particularly for First Nations and gender-diverse people in custody. Urgent concerns include rampant use of solitary confinement, increasingly restrictive parole laws, barriers to healthcare, and restricted family and support network contact. Also in news this week, the Canberra hearings of the National Crowdfunded Public Inquiry into AUKUS began yesterday. A group of former ministers of parliament, retired military and naval officers, leading academics, human rights lawyers, and union leaders committed to the independent inquiry coordinated by the Australian Peace and Security Forum. Those leading the inquiry argue the $400 billion AUKUS deal has not received adequate parliamentary scrutiny. Digital Rights Watch has this week also called for greater scrutiny of AUKUS Pillar 2, which relates to technology and advanced weapons, including AI and cyber capabilities. Experts warn the agreement will deepen the Australian government's reliance on United States military technology, undermine data sovereignty, and threaten individuals' personal information and privacy.
In local news, Darebin Council has scrapped its shared e-bike and e-scooter trial, despite evidence the scheme helped reduce car use and cut carbon emissions. Some councillors warn the decision could undermine the municipality's climate goals. Data from the trial showed nearly half the trips began or ended at public transport stops. 37% were estimated to replace car journeys, and riders during the trial saved more than 1 tonne of carbon emissions.
And finally, in headlines, dugong numbers in the Gulf of Carpentaria have plunged by 50% to an estimated 5,000 animals. With declining seagrass meadows causing high numbers of deaths in one of the world's most important dugong populations, researchers are warning of a serious environmental crisis. First Nations ranger groups are calling for an immediate ban on commercial gillnet fishing and increased government funding for regular surveys to identify causes of the decline. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 3rd of September, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Census night was Tuesday, the 11th of August. The census is compulsory for every household. There's still time to complete. Visit census.abs.gov.au or call 1800 181 227. Authorised by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, Canberra.
A 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast on 3rd of September. How the time is flying. And now we are joined by 3CR Thursday Breakfast favourites, Varda. And Scott Drummond joins us, who's the head of policy and practice, to talk about International Overdose Awareness Day that was on Monday, the 31st of August. And sadly, record numbers of heroin-related overdoses across Victoria, with Geelong sadly taking the leading record for the first time. Now we discuss urgent calls from Geelong to address their overdose crisis, as well as Varda's key statewide election ask. Thank you so much for joining us here today, Scott.
Thanks, Inez, and welcome to spring.
Yes. I hope you've had a nice morning after such a big week, I'm sure. And reflecting on this year's theme of International Overdose Awareness Day is 25 years on, still needed. But I wanted to ask you, from where Victoria has come from those 25 years to today, are there moments that really stick out to you that have really helped advance this state and national harm reduction?
Sure. So International Overdose Awareness Day recognises and acknowledges and asks us to think about individuals, families, communities that have lost loved ones to overdose. We've come a long way. We've still got a long way to go. So, as you say, it's the 30th anniversary. Beg your pardon, 25-year anniversary. But it's also the 30th anniversary of a particularly important report called the Pennington Report many years ago, which was undertaken in response to increasing heroin-related overdoses in Victoria and Melbourne in particular around the late 90s, 1999, and into 2000s. And that really paved the way for a whole lot of harm reduction initiatives. Some of the key ones, which have been introduced in more recent years, actually, and which have really made a significant difference, include the medically supervised injecting room in North Richmond, which has saved hundreds and hundreds of lives and had hundreds of thousands of interactions with individuals who are using drugs and connecting them to services. The pill testing service in Fitzroy, that's just passed its first year anniversary. That's been a really successful harm reduction initiative. That's right. That also included pill testing at festivals, and that's made a significant difference. And then, of course, there's also the availability of naloxone, which is a drug, a nasal spray at the moment, which reverses opioid overdose. It is a life-saving and widely available medication. So there's been a few of the harm reduction initiatives. We've still got a long way to go. And I saw, in fact, in the Herald Sun, only this morning, a lot of criticism about the wraparound health hub on Flinders Street and a lot of stigmatising language, in fact, and unfortunately that goes with that initiative. That's due to open later this year. There's concerns that from traders and the council, and the language they use is really quite stigmatising, unfortunately, about drug users and the challenges they face. So we've got a little way to go, but this week has been International Overdose Awareness Day on Monday. We can also be proud of the accomplishments that we've achieved.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, every year we do a program on it and you often join us, and a lot of it is around what's happening right now, what we need to do, and really telling the stories of lived experience. But I really wanted to ground the conversation. Yes, it's 25 years and we can say there's still so much to do, but Victoria and Australia especially is like really pivotal in harm reduction globally, and there is a lot to be proud of there. And I just wanted to ground the conversation in that we can do so much and we can do so much, and really fighting for the ongoing rights of people that use drugs, and it benefits the entire community when that happens. And yeah, that any rights given can also be taken away, but that's why we have to look out for one another. But following on from that, the core theme is that there is still so much needed. And given the second CBD overdose prevention centre that didn't open, and a lot of the stigmatising language that's kind of discussed, what do the latest overdose-related statistics actually tell us, particularly in relation to heroin-related overdose deaths and why they're happening?
Okay, so yes, this is where we come back down to earth a little bit. We can be proud. We've achieved a lot, and Victoria and Australia led the way in harm reduction. But in coming down to earth, unfortunately, we've seen a significant increase in heroin-related overdoses. And it's on the back of a coronial report into the tragic death of a Geelong woman late last year. And Coroner McGregor reviewed data of overdose deaths across 10 years and found that there's been a significant increase. So, for example, I think the preliminary figures show that the annual number of heroin-involved overdose deaths increased over that time from 172 to 248.
Wow.
So,
can you just repeat those numbers again? Because that's a really significant difference, considering what we've even heard the last few years.
Yeah, that's right. So this is between 2015 and 2024, the annual number of heroin-involved overdose deaths. So that means where heroin's involved. There may be other drugs, and we know that polydrug use is a significant problem. The coroner has identified that as well previously, where nearly three-quarters of overdose deaths in Victoria involve multiple drugs.
Yep.
But heroin is one of the key factors here, and that's increased over that period from 172 to 248. Preliminary data indicate that it's grown again to 261 in 2025. So it's something we really have to focus on and really have to address. There's some interesting questions here around what's happening and why and where. That's the other question.
Yes.
Because we know that Geelong, for example, and that's in fact where this overdose occurred, Geelong reached 45 overdose deaths in 2025, and that's up from only 13, when I say only, tragically 13
of course,
in 2015. So there are areas within Victoria that are seeing, you know, significant harms occurring, and we need to focus on place-based responses to those to really help and support individuals that are experiencing these harms and likely to be at risk, and put in services where they're needed, place-based responses, and exactly as you say, Inez, consulting with community, but importantly consulting with lived and living experience.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, and I think I really want to highlight how important the place-based responses are, because sometimes maybe you can get, some agreement where they say, yes, I agree that these services should exist, but do they have to happen in this area where my kids go to school, where this happens, while there's a pub across the road? And anyway, I just want to talk about why does it matter so much where the places exist, because if people need these services, can they catch buses? Can they get transport? Like, what are the access barriers to getting that kind of support?
Well, access barriers are greater in rural and regional Victoria. That's the first thing I would say. And where it's harder to access services, the risks increase.
Yep.
So we need to, one, work with communities, work with lived and living experience to understand where the harms are occurring, what the harms are, and then where we can locate services. And that's a whole range of services, harm reduction services, treatment and otherwise, as close to where the harms are occurring. And this is one of the debates or one of the issues that's often overlooked in the context of a overdose prevention facility, as you say. And that is, well, why is an overdose prevention facility going here? And the answer to that is that those facilities follow the need. It's not the other way around. So
exactly.
You already have injecting drug use. You already have problematic drug use, overdose deaths, and significant challenges. Facilities like an overdose prevention facility, but other facilities as well, health facilities targeting drug and alcohol users, follow that need. So it's not the other way around. They're not just sort of placed anywhere without good reason. So the idea being that if you can provide services where they're needed, people will access them, which they do, and get the help they need.
Absolutely. I mean, even if people think about their own healthcare, if so much of your physio and your dental and your counselling appointment and your pharmacy is right in your same vicinity, you're more likely to access those services and get the support you need. And as you said, in Greater Geelong or in regional rural, it's so much more difficult. And Greater Geelong said...
That's a good analogy, Inez. Yeah, you're right. Think about exactly how we access health services, all of us. And the further we have to go, the less likely we are to go.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I guess when it comes to Geelong, it's set, sadly, the new record for the LGO of the highest related fatal overdoses than any other regional municipality. Could you, tell us more about what is specifically happening with Geelong? What has kind of been the response? Because the call from the coroner through the report has been, we need active harm reduction measures. We need a centre here. I don't want to spoil what you're going to say, but what has been the responses from Geelong?
Okay, so I think broadly there's a recognition that more services are needed in Geelong, and we'd certainly agree with that, and that's exactly what the coroner has called for in the report into the tragic death of the 33-year-old woman last year. So one of the key recommendations is that the Department of Health urgently consult with drug and alcohol services and people with lived experience in that region to identify and address the gaps in services, resourcing and so on. So let's talk to community, let's understand what the needs are, and then let's put in place more harm reduction services in that region. Unfortunately, our data and our conversations with our members tells us that there's not enough services there, that we need more services. We know that illicit drug markets have pivoted to capture the region, sadly. So illicit drug markets...
What does that mean?
Illicit drug markets are flexible and adaptable. They move also. We can say that with the increase in heroin overdoses in Geelong, that there's a heroin epidemic in that region and that illicit drug markets have moved in. That's not uncommon. They move, they're flexible, but what it does tell us is we've got to adapt as well.
Yes, of course.
We as a service system have to move and be responsive and flexible and adapt as well. So that includes coming into the region, increasing services that are existing in the region, backing in services, increasing availability of things like naloxone, outreach services, pharmacotherapy in particular in the region.
Definitely.
Is hard to access, so we need to increase that as well. We need to invest now because I don't want to be having this conversation with you next year. We're looking at the Geelong data and wringing our hands and saying we need to do more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is still so much work to be done. And as you said, if the illicit drug market is moving and expanding in that area. Services have to as well. And when it comes to like building these services and really adequately co-designing with them, just very briefly, why do you think that co-design is so important, and what can co-design and lived experience really tell you about a service that maybe a regular report evaluation or council stakeout can't?
Great question. So the first thing I'd say in response to that is you've got to listen to the experts. Folks with lived and living experience are the experts. They understand the space, the place, the environment, the needs of drug users. So they have to be front and centre in the conversation. And if you're not going to listen to the experts, my question is, well, who would you listen to
exactly.
when it comes to making policy? And I just come back to the purpose of the coroner and the coroner's recommendations. The purpose of the coroner is to investigate deaths and, but importantly, to prevent deaths and promote public health. So we would place the coroner as an expert in this space. That's their job. That's what they do. That's their task, to prevent death. If we want to prevent death, we need to listen to the coroner. We need to listen to lived and living experience. We need to listen to drug and alcohol experts and place that preservation of life priority as number one. And, you know, that doesn't mean we don't listen to local businesses and services and communities and residents. We need to hear their concerns as well. But I think the preservation of life has to be number one.
Yeah, thank you. It's so important to really prioritise that and, yeah, really balancing it, but not losing sight of, yeah, what we are here for and what Vita is here for. And I know these are part of your key election asks, and we are coming up to the end of our time, but would you mind just briefly going over what Vita is asking from the next potential Victorian state government?
Yeah, sure. So we're calling for a stronger, better resourced harm reduction system. And in the context of International Overdose Awareness Day this week, we'd like to see better resourced needle and syringe programs statewide. We'd like to see an expanded drug checking or pill testing services statewide. More medically supervised injecting rooms or overdose prevention facilities where they're needed. That might be, for example, really very, very small services, not larger services, small-scale services that can respond to need. And, I think, as I've mentioned, the other thing we have to do and get better at, and we've talked about this for some time, is strengthening access to pharmacotherapies such as long-acting injectable buprenorphine and methadone, these sorts of medications, which are evidence-based, life-saving and effective.
Yeah. I mean, truly some incredible medications that are so life-saving, similar to naloxone, just truly, yeah, the long-term benefit for pharmacotherapy is revolutionary. And I want to leave us on that, and that there is still so much work to be done, but reach out to Vita if you want to learn more, and we'll have how to contact Vita and read about their state election ask as well as International Overdose Awareness Day. But thank you so much again, Scott, for joining us here today on 3CR.
Thanks, Inez. Well done.
Thank you. Bye. And that was Scott Drummond, Head of Policy and Practice at VADA, the Victorian Peak for Alcohol and Other Drug Agencies, joining me to talk about International Overdose Awareness Day, which was on Monday, the 31st of August, and sadly the record number of heroin-related overdoses in Victoria, with Geelong sadly taking the leading record, and what Geelong's response has been to that. And we discussed urgent calls from Geelong to address the overdose crisis, as well as VADA's key statewide election asks. Stay tuned for our next segment, but currently it is 7:29.
Join the Homeless Persons Union Victoria on our new radio show on the mighty 3CR.
Listen in as we embark on a public experiment to grow a homelessness union from the grassroots and on the radio.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a new monthly show on 3CR that seeks to grow a homelessness union in public view and to a wide audience.
We'll speak to people involved in community development, to allies, activists, and anyone who has anything interesting to say about homelessness issues in Melbourne today. Most importantly, we will centre the voices of people who are homeless in Melbourne and beyond.
Featuring interviews, guests, as well as analysis of policy, laws and media discourse that affect the homeless community.
Tune in on 3CR, 855am on Tuesday, September the 8th, 12am to 1am for our premier broadcast.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a proud affiliate show of
the Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 8:55 a.m. 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is Starfish. Time is running out.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:31 in the morning. And we are now joined in the studio by Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, who's speaking with us about Rahu's recent successes with collective tenant bargaining and its implications for future tenant organising in Victoria. And we will also be talking about upcoming rental reforms that come into effect on the 13th of October, as well as some key concerns and commitments that tenants should be mindful of when it comes to the November state elections. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Thanks for joining us in the studio. I'm excited about the topic that we'll be talking about today because I think this concept of collective tenant bargaining has been a challenging one to get off the ground in so-called Australia, even though we do have, you know, forms of tenancy where people all do have the same landlord, like public housing traditionally and community housing. It's been a lot more challenging to engage in that kind of organizing when it comes to private rental tenants. So can you maybe start us off with a bit of the principle of collective tenant bargaining and what that means in this context?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe also a bit as to why it's been challenging historically in Australia in the private rental market. So in other countries like Canada or Spain or Sweden, you can walk up to a big block of units and it'll all be owned by the same landlord. You do that in Australia and every single unit can be owned by a different property owner. So it's much more difficult to traditionally collectively bargain like tenant unions do in those countries. So historically in Australia, it's been difficult to kick off. But the principle behind collective bargaining is very similar to that in the labor unions, where you find a single employer, you get all their workers together, you get them in a room, talk about their issues, and then figure out what you do from there. And that can be as simple as sending a letter outlining your demands very clearly and what you need. Or it can be as severe in advance as a strike. And so like how workers walk off the job if their demands aren't met, tenants can withhold their rent if their demands are not met. But that is that's quite a later step. That's quite a big step. And so as I mentioned, there's many things in between that tenants can do to exercise their bargaining power. And the main idea is that, you know, by yourself, you don't have a lot of power against your landlord and your agent. You know, your landlord and your agent have wealth, they have experience, they have professionals, they have stability. Whereas, you know, by yourself, a lot of tenants don't have those things, right? And landlords are able to, you know, take advantage of that. But if tenants get together, there's a sense of security in a collective. And also your bargaining power increases significantly because all of a sudden it's not just one flow of income that's being threatened to the landlord, it's all of them or a vast majority of them. And so the landlord has to take that seriously if they want to maintain their operations as is. And so it's the ethos behind collective bargaining is harnessing that power to get a fairer outcome for tenants.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really powerful thing to have tenants being able to identify their relationship to each other through the same landlord and to then talk about what they want together. But, you know, without giving too much of your strategy away, I did want to ask about how you've been able to operationalize this here, because, you know, a lot of folks live, for example, in, you know, detached dwellings where they may be share housing, and it can be kind of difficult and opaque to tell who your landlord is, let alone how many other people share the same landlord.
Yeah, absolutely. We have been able to get around it, which is great. In South Australia last week, we fought off a 5% rent increase for people who live in a share house, or a few different tenants who live in share houses. So we have found ways against it. I'll say it's a mix of lots of research, but also landlords and their agents can be quite sloppy. They haven't been challenged in a long time, and if I had to give them a piece of advice, you know, be a bit less open. You know, things are out and open much more than they think, and we're able to find things pretty easily. So that's probably the most I can say about strategy.
Yeah,
but no. I think the important thing to emphasize is that if you have a landlord and the landlord is mistreating you, or you have various problems and you want to pursue something like collective bargaining, we are able to link up all the different tenants of that landlord. Let's say they have three properties in North Melbourne, three in South Melbourne, a couple out in, I don't know, Werribee. We're able to link you guys all up and, you know, create a group chat or invite you all out to some kind of event or something, and collectively bargain from there. And we can do that across state bounds as well. If they've got properties in, I don't know, Queensland, we can bring those tenants as well. We've got a Brisbane branch now. So, you know, we're able to establish those networks.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredibly exciting, and I think has big implications for the future of tenant organizing here. And I did want to ask you about some of those implications, but also if you could take us through some of the recent wins that you've had. You just gestured to one before.
Yeah. In South Australia, one in, Victoria we had last week. We fought off an 11% rent increase, from the landlord. We also are in the process of getting urgent repairs done. So that's been getting done this week. There's been, mold doctor coming in. There's been this, that, various problems at the property being addressed. So that's been a really big win. Those tenants, they were, served an 11% rent increase. And this is, you know, over short, medium term, this is thousands of dollars. You know, it's a lot of money for tenants. This can be life-changing for tenants. This will be life-changing for tenants. It just means for the landlord, their property is slightly less lucrative. So,
And I did actually just want to ask a follow-up on that, which is, are you seeing when you have these sort of collective bargaining cases that the same sort of measures are being applied across different properties? So was it that everybody got an 11% rent increase, or, are some people getting it, some people not? And then in other cases where you're challenging conditions, is it that the same landlord is letting all properties run down? What are the sort of patterns that you're seeing as you start doing this?
It's really heterogeneous. It really varies a lot. So sometimes the agent or the manager will be very much trying to control everything. They'll be the kind of arbiter. Sometimes the landlord is willing to have a conversation or to be a point of contact. Sometimes we have to hunt down the landlord, figuratively, obviously. We have to find out, you know, who they are, where they are, any points of contact, and sometimes they still refuse to negotiate. So it really varies across every case, to be honest, how cooperative and how good faith landlords and their agents are. I will say I've noticed a significant trend of landlords and agents not operating good faith, which may come to a big surprise to many of your listeners. I would say that they try and, in my experience anyway, more often than not, landlords and their agents try and shut down negotiation. They try and monopolize the flow of communication. They try and minimize the transparency of information. They try and really reinforce that information asymmetry where tenants don't have access to a lot of information and landlords have access to all the information. So, but it does really vary. So for this specific one, to get back to your question, it was just a 11% around all the same time. But sometimes that will vary. Sometimes just vary, depends on when people sign the lease and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But sometimes one person 1 month will get one, maybe the next month. It does vary a lot depending on the case.
Well, I think it does show a lot of promise for tenants being able to leverage some collective power. And I think, as you said, you know, it is unfortunate that you're seeing landlords and real estate agents not being, you know, on balance amenable to coming to the table. But I think they will also possibly realize this is in their interests as well. If you think about the sort of transaction costs of having to undertake an eviction and going to court or VCAT and then having to re-tenant the property, you know, and at the end of the day, it does seem like there is some leaning into the power imbalances that already exist where, you know, this is an investment property for the landlord and this is the home for the tenant. But it is really good to hear that people are feeling, you know, more emboldened to engage in that action.
We put so much effort to try and get them to the negotiating table in good faith. We try and get to that point where they're not, spending so much time and money and resources on this and that. And it's just, you know, time and time again, despite our attempts to establish good faith negotiations, we don't really get anywhere. So unfortunately, the only thing that seems to work more often than not are those more direct tactics and escalations. And yeah, as I said, we put so much effort into trying to establish those communication lines to negotiate and have a good conversation. But, you know, if push comes to shove, I'm going to pick the living standards of my members and tenants over the comfort of a particular landlord.
Well said. And now I just wanted to turn towards the next raft of changes that are coming up for Vic renters. So these rules will be coming into effect. They've already been passed in legislation, but they come into effect from the 13th of October. And we have a couple of different changes coming through that will affect, you know, the rental conditions of Victorians. What do people have to look forward to and what should they be mindful of?
Yeah, so the ones for October will be strengthening bond claims. So rental providers must notify the renter in advance. They'll be making a claim on their bond at the end of the agreement. Landlords must keep records of them complying with minimum standards when it was advertised for rent. Landlords must ensure that mandatory gas and electrical safety checks are done every 2 years. Landlords must do a gas check before draft proofing. And then there's also now a ban on rental providers and agents charging any fees for applications. So these, it sounds kind of very boring and, wordy. And they're minor reforms, but they're positive reforms. This is about, making sure that, for example, with bond claims, that tenants, that landlords aren't getting away with dodgy bond claims. Some of the stuff that we've had to deal with is people just not being aware of the rights they have around claiming their bond or the fact that they, it is their bond.
Yeah.
We've dealt with cases so egregious that the landlord didn't actually file the bond with the bond authority. They just kept the money for themselves. And, you know, particularly we now have tenants who maybe English isn't their first language, or they're struggling because they're working a couple jobs and they've got kids at home and they just don't have the time to go through the legislation. All of a sudden, you know, that's a couple thousand dollars that they can't get back. And so, you know, things that we've been able to do, for example, is win that money back and then refer the landlord to Consumer Affairs Victoria and get them fined. So, and I think that leads into a broader point about legislative changes, is that these are good changes, but they're not worth the paper they're printed on if they can't be enforced. What the literature says time and time again is, even if you increase regulation, even if you put all these new laws into practice, if they're not enforced, then they're not really worth much, right? And the thing that's keeping them from being enforced is the fact that tenants fear retaliation. They fear their landlord. The landlord and agent have, again, they have more knowledge, they have more experience, they have professionals on their side.
They have resources.
They have resources that tenants don't have. They have time, security that tenants don't have. And so if there isn't a force to counterbalance that, then there's no one there to enforce these laws, or there's not a lot there, and so that's where we come in, and we tenants' union are able to enforce these laws.
In wrapping up and building on that point, when it comes to enforceability, what will you be looking to in the upcoming state election? What are some of your key concerns, and have you seen any moves in this space that look encouraging?
Unfortunately, when it comes to elections, discussions about renting and that side of the cost of living crisis haven't been too prevalent in public discourse. Whenever housing is brought up in the public discourse, it's usually about home ownership and how it can institute relief for people who have mortgages and interest rates and property prices and this, that, and the third. And these are all important discussions, but it seems to overtake the really pressing rental crisis that we're seeing across the country and in different states. And that's no different here than in Victoria, unfortunately. If we look at the Liberal Party or One Nation, very rarely do they ever really talk about renting. And if they do, it's, in regards to One Nation, they talk about in relation to migration. They never really talk about it in relation to anything else. And when it comes to the Liberals, they're often the ones saying that we need to cut back all these new protections that renters have won. We need to cut back regulation, red tape, and all that stuff. So, unfortunately, from the conservative side of politics, it's not too promising.
Yeah.
We're seeing some good rhetoric from the left side of politics. So obviously, the Labor Party is instituting these new reforms. The Greens have been strong advocates. The Victorian Socialists have been strong advocates for renters' rental reform. But overall, the public discourse can often leave the question of renting out, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, in that case, it is up to tenant organizers to keep the pressure on, and we really appreciate the work that the Renter and Housing Union does. And thank you so much, Adu, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, who spoke with us about Rahu's recent successes with collective tenant bargaining, implications for future tenant organizing, and some upcoming rental reforms. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. You are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:49 in the morning. And if you're just joining us earlier this morning, you heard from Scott Drummond from VADA, talking about International Overdose Awareness Day, which was on Monday, the 31st of August. And then we were joined by Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, talking about some collective bargaining wins. And now we are joined by Bibi Oliver, who is a Bardi Jawi poet, author, illustrator, and artistic director and CEO of Black and Bright, who's joining us to talk about the opening of Black and Bright's 2026 Literary Festival. Now, this year's festival theme, Every When, centers First Nations understandings of time as continuous and relational. Through a series of workshops, panels, and performances starting today, Thursday the 3rd of September, and running until this Saturday the 6th, audiences will engage with stories and conversations that challenge linear notions of past, present, and future. Good morning, Bibi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. It's my absolute pleasure.
Just to begin with, can you tell us a bit more about your connection to the work that you do? How did you come to work in the Black literary space?
Yes, so 2018 was when I got my foot in the door for the first time, and that was a huge thanks to Anita Heiss, one of our most celebrated Aboriginal authors in the country.
Mm.
I was published in the anthology Growing Up Aboriginal in Australia, and at that point I had no kind of, you know, working within the Black literary industry wasn't on my radar. I always did work within the creative industry. That's where my passion was creating experiences for the community to enjoy. But from there, I really had a newfound love with Black stories. And Black stories being vehicle for Black truth-telling and, you know, the living embodiment of cultural identity and knowledge. So that really sparked it for me, and I shortly after joined the board of directors for Mugabala Books, published a couple of my own books then from my own experiences as an Aboriginal, a gay Aboriginal person, and... then pivoted, you know, throughout those different industries of government and pediatric health and all sorts of things, and then realised my true calling was working completely within Black literary spaces, and that's when I joined Black and Bright.
That is an incredible journey in, and I also think speaks to the testament of having really wonderful mentorship and support in that space. And I'm sure that's something that you have been able to provide in your role now is, you know, uplifting young Black voices, you know, giving them a foothold in this space. And there, I wanted to ask about how Black and Bright diverts away from Western literary models and how the organization supports the self-determination and self-expression of First Nations voices.
Yeah, that notion of mentorship and support is one of the strongest things within Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. It's that sense of togetherness and you know, working with each other to keep connections strong and ongoing through generations, through communities, through kin, through familial connections. Black and Bright, we self-govern. We're a First Nations-led organisation. We work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities across the country, not just to deliver our Writers' Festival, but every other event and program and initiative that we run across the country. With our Writers' Festival specifically, you know, we look at models and organizations across the country and across the world. They're constantly responding to the zeitgeist and, you know, chasing the dollar. What sells the most at the moment? Black and Bright doesn't believe in that. We prefer to showcase, spotlight, and platform the voices that matter, the stories that matter. You know, it's not about what the community wants to be hearing right now. It's about what the, you know, the broader community, that is. It's about what our authors, our storytellers want to be saying and what the broader community needs to be hearing. You know, we are really, really proud the fact that Black and Bright only turns 10 this year. But within that time, we've placed ourselves in the position of, out of all literary festivals across the country, we actually pay our storytellers the most. We're extremely proud of that. And what we see time and time again, especially over the last few years, is this ongoing silencing and censorship of storytellers and their thoughts and their perspectives and experiences. But we're constantly reminding our storytellers that you have the authority over your own story and how you tell them. This is your stage. We're just here to provide you with the opportunities. Go forward, tell the stories that matter, tell your truth. If you have a differing view, if you disagree, great, even better. But, you know, there is, we don't look for a single black voice, or we don't demand consensus. And the other thing that I'm really proud of with Black and Bright Writers Festival is that we recognise story and storytelling as not just oral tradition, but performance, song, poetry, dance, conversations, and country-based storytelling as well, because they all centre First Nations ways of knowing and telling.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much in that about, you know, the scaffolding work that the organisation does to create, you know, not just a safe but a generative landing space for Black authors, and to then, you know, integrate all of the important traditions of storytelling that has been occurring in this place since time immemorial, with a contemporary real valuation of, you know, authors' contributions. And I did want to ask you about this year's festival theme, Every When, and how, you know, that links into these questions of temporality and time in storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, Every When is one of my favourite terms ever. I think it's just, it's so poetic and it's so beautiful. You know, humans, we have this obsession with beginnings and endings, and we want to know when something started and when it finished, and, you know, who came first and what happened next. And we draw these, we draw lines, you know, through, we draw lines through time, and we call it history. But for First Nations people, country itself is centric to our existence and to our purposes on this planet. And so our connection to country, we know that country doesn't behave like that, and we know that memory doesn't behave like that. And, of course, as Black people, love certainly doesn't behave like that. So we've always known that time is so much more than a straight line, and the way that I see this theme of Every When weaving itself through the festival is just the ways of thinking and knowing, and that our old people, our elders and our ancestors can be gone but still in the room at the same time. And one of our stories can be thousands of generations old but still be alive in our mouths today. And so it's looking at the fact that forever isn't somewhere ahead, that maybe it's happening right now, and that perhaps this idea and concept of eternity is the Every When all at once. And I think it's a really quite ridiculous but magnificent thing to think about. And so the festival this year asks us to remember that Black stories don't begin when somebody decides to publish them, but it begins, you know, where our stories have been here before the institutions existed that now catalogue and present them. And so we were writing before paper, in sky, in song, in memory, in bodies, and we're still writing. And so that's what we're going to be recognising in the festival this year, is encountering Black writing in forms we recognise and forms that we might not.
Yeah, I mean, that is the... I'm just sort of blown away by the beauty of that theme, and it really made me think of a book that I had the privilege of actually finally sitting down and getting to read early this year, which is J.M. Field's The Eagle and the Crow. And yeah, just thinking about that incredibly beautiful, you know, narrative that is also not told in linear time, but spells out an intricate mathematic analysis of Gamilaré conceptions of time and place and generations, that, yeah, your explanation of Every When was really evocative of that. And, you know, this notion of familiarity and intergenerational knowledge is, I think, something that's really profound in this year's festival theme. And could you tell us about what events are lined up for the festival this year? And is there anything that you're looking forward to in particular over the next 4 days of programming?
I'm looking forward to absolutely everything. We open tonight with a performance called Gathering. at the Capitol Theatre in the city, and it's a really special one-night-only performance by a brilliant storyteller, Luke Curry Richardson, that speaks about real experiences of racism, you know, the use of social media to platform people of colour and black identity, but then to simply use them as vehicles for the economy and for income. And then we close the festival on Sunday night with a beautiful event. We've planned something really special, and it's at Camp Sovereignty. It's called Beneath the Sky. You know, we've got incredible people such as Ziggy Ramo, Curly Saunders, Ellen Badney have been performing that night. But then we've got these really fun, interesting things that we've absolutely never done before. And an example of that is this event called Critical Yarn, which is a Dungeons & Dragons-themed event. A Yaru storyteller, Brenton McKenna, he's written an original story which Keenan Muir from Indiginerd has then turned into a Dungeons & Dragons game and quest. And so everyone's going to be sitting around playing this game for a few hours and eating some dapper. So we're exploring, you know, concepts and ideas of that kind of storytelling as well. But then we've got a whole array of incredible panels on black love. We've got an incredible panel of young, early career Aboriginal writers, and we're giving them the stage to talk about their stories and giving them that power and license and authority to talk about their journeys and how they've begun, where they want to go. And that's called Tomorrow Rising and delivered in partnership with Emerging Writers Festival. We've got a suite of incredible workshops, you know, one for children and young people and their families called Future Maker, which is tomorrow and Saturday at Ngarrindjeri Library. We've got a Right Way Forward workshop series, Tony Birch, Charmaine Ledden-Lewis and Brenton McKenna delivering different kinds of writing workshops, as well as Dakota Fairright on poetry, happening at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies and Watsonia Library. So we've got so much happening over the next 4 days in so many different locations. We're really proud to be taking the festival regionally as well. We've got programming in Ballarat as well. So there's honestly something for everybody at the festival.
That is an incredible lineup and an incredible diversity of programming, from your traditional panel discussion to this Dungeons and Dragons, you know, narrative arc, which, you know, shout out Kenan, that is amazing. Just to wrap up, who can come to the writing workshops, panels and performances, and do you have any advice for people out there who might be feeling a bit shy about a writing workshop?
Black and Bright's underlying ethos is black stories are for everyone. We want as many people as possible all across the country to experience the power, the beauty and the magic of black stories and black books. So absolutely anyone can come to the writing workshops. You don't need to have any previous or prior experience. Just come with an open mind and a dedication and an interest in trying something new. You're going to be safe. You're going to be nurtured and looked after. And you get to leave with a story that you write, or a poem that you write, or an illustration that you create. Brenton McKenna is also going to be teaching about comic book writing. So you might even leave with your own little comic strip. Who knows?
Awesome.
But, you know, the biggest piece of advice that I've ever received about, you know, the newness and the introduction to the writing space, whether it's through a workshop or just sitting down at the computer at home, is to simply believe in what you're writing and what you're wanting to create. So, like I said, you're going to be safe in the workshops. The Black and Bright, where you know, safety for the entire community is central to what we do and the experiences we want to create. So just come along, know that you're going to have fun, and knowing that you're going to be creating something wonderful, not just for you, but for the people that you know, the people that are around you who can read what you create too.
beautiful. And also, you know, no pressure, folks. This might be the start of something. You don't have to come out of this with a fully formed, you know, polished product, but maybe this opens the door to a deeper engagement with some of the storytelling that you want to do. So thank you so much, Bibi, for joining us this morning. Are there any words you want to leave us with?
Just a reminder that we open tonight at the Capitol Theatre with Gathering. Head to www.blackandbright.com.au to browse the program. And remember, black stories are for everyone.
Amazing. Thank you, Bibi. I really appreciate your time and hope you have a wonderful day and good luck with the festival.
Thank you so much.
And that was Bibi Oliver, a Bardijawi poet, author, and illustrator, and the artistic director and CEO of Black and Bright, who joined us to talk about the opening of Black and Bright's 2026 Literary Festival, which is themed this year, Every When, centering First Nations understandings of time as continuous and relational. There will be a series of workshops, panels, and performances starting today, as Bibi just mentioned, Thursday, the 3rd of September at the Capitol Theatre, and running until this Sunday the 6th, where audiences can engage with stories and conversations challenging linear notions of past, present, and future. And again, you can take a look at the program and book your tickets by going to www.black, that's B-L-A-K, and bright.com.au. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:06 in the morning.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
ThreeCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Yeah, I took a trip to the astral plains to hear the voice of my people say, Nilagura John, make a way, listen to the news like brand new day. And even if you weren't born on this continent, you're still part of the war to protect what's left. We gotta weather the storm, then clear the deck. Mind is torn, but I won't forget that I'm proud of the place I'm from. Making the family strong, being the pride. We need to find the cheaper life than a state full of debt where the leaders lie.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast, and it is 8:08 in the morning now on Thursday, the 3rd of September. And we are now joined by Dr. Ruchira Talukdar, co-founder and coordinator of SUPNA South Asian Climate Solidarity, who is speaking with us today about the importance of situating the recent catastrophic flooding in Nepal and Tibet in the broader context of climate change effects in the Himalayas. And Ruchira is also speaking about the responsibility of high-emitting wealthy countries such as Australia to provide climate finance to regions bearing the brunt of climate disaster. Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Priya.
Yeah, of course. I'm really keen to cover this issue because, you know, it has been an incredibly sobering week looking at the absolutely catastrophic impacts of the flooding across Nepal and Tibet, and you know, relief efforts are still underway, and you know, so many people are still missing. We don't yet know the full scale of the damage and what's going to be required to repair. But I think at this point in time, it is important to take stock of some of the, you know, contextual factors that lead into these kinds of catastrophes, and also what those implications are for people around the world who are invested in climate justice. So, first of all, the exact mechanism that triggered this flood event is still being investigated, but it has occurred within the context of quite a well-established pattern of climate change-induced environmental disasters in the Himalayas, including flooding in Nepal as recently as last year. Now, can you talk about this context, so how climate change has reshaped, in particular, the Hindu Kush Himalaya?
That's right. So we know that the Hindu Kush Himalayas, which is the world's youngest mountain range, is warming rapidly. But what that means is very complex, and there is still a lot that needs to be found out, and which is why early warning systems and monitoring mechanisms are crucial. So reports suggest that the melting of the glaciers has happened 65% faster in the last decade in the Hindu Kush Himalayas than the decade before. But as science articles have pointed out, since the disaster particularly, that its melting glaciers are just not straightforwardly, you know, a matter of the shrinking of ice cover. When glaciers melt, the meltwater can get trapped in lakes, and those lakes can expand or they can contract, and an avalanche can set off a cascade of flooding downstream. So in this particular case, it was initially thought that it could have been triggered by an earthquake, because we are talking about the world's most seismically volatile region. But that was not the case. It is what has been recognized as a high altitude glacier collapse, or basically an ice and rock avalanche, which is very indicative of, you know, one of the ways in which glaciers melt and disasters are caused. So scientists and science writers trying to unpack the complexity with which the Hindu Kush Himalayas is changing talk about the fact that it is a complex system, and there are many different ways in which unpredictable changes are occurring. So that's kind of the science language behind it. But it has real impacts on people, on millions of people. 241 million people directly live in the mountain ecosystem across 8 countries, from Afghanistan in the northwest right down to Myanmar in the southeast, across the Hindu Kush region. And, you know, a kind of much more than that depend on the snow-fed glaciers for subsistence and survival.
I think putting that into context, the fact that, you know, these kinds of catastrophic events don't respect borders. Borders are just lines on maps. And yet these are, mountain regions that have been undergoing, as you said, significant, human-induced climate change changes. There are so many lives that are at stake when these events occur. And I wanted to ask you about the scale of the impact and a bit more about who has been impacted by this recent flood event across Nepal and Tibet.
So, of course, first and foremost, the locals. And while we know, you know, with a certain amount of certainty about lives lost and people missing from the side of Nepal, we don't have the same amount of clarity about what's gone in Tibet. And that's something that, you know, Tibetan people in exile. I was at the vigil in solidarity at Federation Square the other night, and they talk about the fact that we don't know yet what the casualties are on that side, both in terms of people missing and in terms of lives lost. So there are the known elements of the disaster and then the unknown elements. The other thing that's worth noting is who gets spoken about the least, the casualties, the kind of people who get spoken about the least. So if we think about, the people missing, Nepal updated a list of 900 people who are workers on hydroelectric projects who are missing, you know, and they're being searched for in the tunnels. So while locals, you know, kind of, and tourists and Australians who have been stranded are being talked about, the people who are the faceless casualties of this disaster are workers in hydroelectric projects who come from poor families, poor Nepali families, poor Tibetan families. And what are hydroelectric projects of that scale doing in the world's most precarious terrain anyway? That's another thing to unpack.
Yeah, well, I would love to hear a bit more about that, because I think that does also link into part of the unseen scale of the catastrophe in this place where, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of the news coverage is, you know, to an extent, understandably, talking about Australian foreign nationals that are in Nepal who might have been affected. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily give us a window into the full picture.
Absolutely. So at Sapna South Asian Climate Solidarity, we've organized a series of webinars because it's really important to unpack the interlocking challenges that communities in places like Nepal and Tibet and across the mountains are facing, what they're faced with, what kind of so-called clean energy solutions like dams are foisted on them, and what real climate solutions mean for them, what is required. So the first webinar will unpack the science and will unpack the complex ways in which the ecosystems are shifting. That's on the 10th. The second one is about how diaspora contributes, you know, to kind of immediate loss and damage and climate compensation and how governments have responsibility. I'll talk about that a bit later because we're going to be talking on that topic. The third one is about dams, which is on the 1st of October. All the details are on our website. I'd really urge our listeners to be in the conversation. So I just want to talk about the fact that just before coming in the studio, I was reading a long article, which is based on a media statement that Friends of the Earth Nepal and groups in the region put out yesterday. The interesting fact is, in light of the disaster, you know, we've come to know that glacial lake flooding monitoring mechanism, resilience mechanism for which Nepal had applied to the Green Climate Fund, the Climate Finance Fund, International Climate Finance Fund, it took 7 years to approve and come in. And that delay could have been instrumental in just not providing the information that was necessary, you know, kind of about this catastrophe. On the other hand, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, multilateral agencies have been funding big dams, mega projects in the mountains, which, of course, you know, happen quickly and there is no 7 year delay. So you have to look at what is enabled and what is not enabled in the global politics of energy and climate solutions and funding and who benefits and who loses out.
And
so we're going to talk about this.
Yeah, and this is like a real disparity in, you know, in the nuances of energy transition politics, because on the one hand, you're talking about the establishment of industries, hydroelectric power that is, you know, notionally a green energy solution in the region, but also, you know, comes up against the real material concerns of people who are living in that region who are trying to mitigate the impacts of climate change on these catastrophic flood events. And so I can see how those things are in tension, and it must be incredibly challenging for, you know, people in the region who are trying to sound the alarm about the impacts of the energy industry on, you know, their lived realities here. Now, I did want to ask, there does continue to be this massive geographic imbalance between those regions that bear significant responsibility for emissions output and those that bear the brunt of climate catastrophe. So you spoke about that real delay in international climate finance for you know, flood warning systems. And when it comes to climate finance responsibilities in general, to cover things like warning systems, mitigation, adaptation measures, what responsibilities do you see Australia and other nations holding to South Asia?
So, you know, the conversation has grown in the last few days around Nepal's climate justice. So Nepal's foreign minister has been, you know, on television and has Nepal has presented a climate bill to the world's top three emitters, which is the US, China and India. Now, what is interesting is, where is Australia in all of this? So I, you know, kind of when I did my doctorate, I researched the climate politics of India and Australia. And India is now one of the world's highest emitters, but, you know, India still has one of the lowest per capita emissions, and India does hide behind the poor in terms of its emissions. That's an interesting point. But what Australia hides behind is the fact that our population is so less that we are not a big net emitter, but Australia is one of the largest coal exporters. So on and on we go in the global, you know, politics of emissions. But where is Australia on this? Australia has, like wealthy nations do, climate obligations. Australia has obligations for, you know, kind of climate finance for adaptation, as well as the loss and damage climate compensation. Now, Australia so far has provided climate finance and some loss and damage funding to, you know, the Pacific region. But as Pacific leaders have pointed out, there's much more that's needed. So our argument is that there are a few kind of interesting characteristics of the South Asian diaspora, which kind of make it self-evident that Australia should be supporting climate finance, resilience building, and loss and damage compensation in Australia, in South Asia. Now, kind of collectively South Asians, Nepalese, Indian, Bangladeshis, you know, kind of all of us South Asians collectively, other nations and nation diasporas included, we are Australia's largest migrant community. Now, year on year, after every natural disaster, communities pool together money and send it back home, as we have seen with the fundraiser by the diaspora Nepalese community right now. And last year, after the catastrophic floods across Punjab in India and Pakistan, the amount of money that was sent back, I was back in Punjab a few months ago looking at what that money is doing on the ground in places where communities, you know, have received the money from their friends and families in Australia. So this, in a way, at this point of time, because climate finance from wealthy countries has been so unforthcoming in the last 10 years in global politics, you know, we know about the US and other things that have been going on. In that vacuum, money sent by diaspora after these catastrophes is recognized as the single most viable way in which climate finance is flowing from the global north to the global south. So think about it, the largest migrant community in Australia is evidently year upon year sending more money back as, you know, our personal loss and damage contributions to our countries and communities back home. Now, Australia parallelly has an obligation. So whether or not Australia is the world's top emitter doesn't matter. The fact that, you know, kind of the largest migrant community in Australia is continuously providing climate finance and loss and damage compensation for the communities puts Australia, who is one of the world's largest coal exporters, in that place of accountability of fulfilling its obligations towards South Asia, towards countries like Nepal, upstream, countries like Bangladesh, downstream, who are not small island countries, but in their own categories, absolutely vulnerable small countries from, you know, kind of the developing part of the world.
Yeah, and I do want to touch on that massive amount of loss and damage compensation funding that is just grassroots mutual aid, you know, community fundraising that then goes towards now, you know, the non-resident Nepalese organizations fundraising has gone to the Prime Minister's, you know, disaster relief fund in Nepal. It is diaspora communities that are putting the money in for this. And I guess I wanted to ask you about the notion of green remittances and how this fits into the broader remittance economy as well.
Well, this fits in, you know, kind of in a very big way into the big remittance economy, because people, like, one of the first things migrants do, economic migrants, you know, coming from the global south to the global north, one of the first things they do is send money back home. Now, migrants send even more money back home after so-called natural disasters because you're helping your community get back on their feet. So we are starting to do some study, and we will be looking at, you know, if possible, because it's really hard to track remittances because they go as individual donations. But we're going to try and see if there is a big spike in the kind of money people are sending back home. We're going to look at the, you know, the last 5 years and major climate events in South Asia. And we're going to look at, try and see if we can find spikes in people's donations to get a sense of the scale of contributions that go in after natural disasters as opposed to regularly. So that is one thing too. So Sapna is, we are going to South Asian communities in Australia. We are wanting to talk to them about joining the dots between what they do, recognizing what they do in terms of fundraising, you know, solidarity work as their climate action. You know, recognizing that they're doing that and there is a critical dearth of that parallel action by, you know, the government of the wealthy country they're living in, like Australia, you know, towards South Asian countries. So it's important for diaspora to start joining the dots between what they do and what is obligated of, you know, the Australian government. It's important for diaspora to support climate, you know, organizations, youth climate coalitions from back in places like Nepal and Bangladesh. Every time there's a catastrophe, youth climate groups from Nepal, from Bangladesh, countries like that, stand up and say that, you know, the world owes us loss and damage. So it's important for diaspora to join the dots between the work they're doing of organizing and sending money back home and joining the dots with the calls coming from their countries for loss and damage.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's also making me reflect on the fact that people's participation in, you know, climate change relief efforts, especially in culturally and linguistically diverse communities where home countries are impacted significantly by climate change effects, may not be immediately apparent in Australian climate politics, but there is nonetheless still this participation. So I think having that more expansive understanding will be really important. Look, I want to
acknowledge what you just said, Priya, because that's absolutely critical. I've myself been in climate organizations in Australia for a long time, and I've worked in climate organizations in India too. And it is something that's not recognized as, well, diaspora themselves probably don't see their work as climate organizing, but they should recognize it as such, because that's how it's read. And climate organizations do not consider this, you know, kind of climate organizing. So kind of it is necessary to look at where diaspora is already doing something and recognize the significance of that and start from there in terms of having a climate conversation. So it's absolutely important for all of us to recognize this work, because sending money back home and remittances in themselves don't get recognized. Like, migrants don't get recognized for playing this role in paying taxes here, caring for communities, their community here, as well as caring for their families and communities back home, especially after disasters of this scale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how this work continues to develop to build those connections. Look, Ruchira, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope folks have started to do a bit more thinking about how these issues are all connected.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Ruchira Talukdar, co-founder and coordinator of SUPNA South Asian Climate Solidarity, speaking with us about the importance of contextualizing much more broadly the recent catastrophic flooding in Nepal and Tibet, and also, you know, the relief efforts that have been underway and how they're funded. Now, that's about all we have time for on our show today. Do you want to take us through a quick rundown of what we've had on?
Absolutely. So first up, we heard from Scott Drummond, the head of policy and practice at VADA, about International Overdose Awareness Day and heroin-related deaths in Victoria and Geelong and their key statewide election asks.
After that, we heard from Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, talking about some recent successes with collective tenant bargaining. And we were then joined by Bibi Oliver, Bardi Jawi, poet, author, illustrator, and artistic director and CEO of Black and Bright, to talk about the festival running from today to Sunday the 6th. And of course, as you just heard, we were joined by Dr. Ruchira Talukdar from SUPNA South Asian Climate Solidarity, speaking about the recent catastrophic flooding in Nepal and Tibet and some of the broader context of climate change effects and climate remittances. We will catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast. For now, stay tuned for Lost in Science.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.